I want to begin today with a narrative, and I'd like to start with a narrative because I think that it's a powerful way to kind of impart a message on people. And I'd like to start by asking all of you to picture yourselves as characters within this narrative that I'm about to tell. I think it'll be familiar to a lot of people here. But I want you to imagine that you're living in Egypt, and the year is 1450 BC. I want you to imagine that you're an Israelite, a slave, being held in captivity, and that this life of captivity and slavery and servitude is all that you've ever known. And I want you to imagine that this life is the only life that your parents have ever known, that all they've ever known is slavery and bondage and captivity in the land of Egypt, serving Pharaoh, serving in a strange land among strange people, not allowed to worship their God as they please, and not allowed to believe what they want to believe or work on what they want to work on. And I want you to imagine that your parents' parents and their parents and everyone in your tribe for the last 450 years has only ever known servitude and captivity in this land at the service of Pharaoh. I want you to try and imagine how hopeless you might feel, not just in your own life, hopeless that you would never escape this captivity, hopeless that you would never feel relief or be able to worship your God as you chose or live how you chose to live. But I also want you to imagine having to somehow find a way to give your children hope, because you know deep down that there's little hope for you or for those who come after you, because all you've ever known for 450 years, your entire tribe, is servitude and slavery. And sure, the elders within your community, the leaders of your clan, they may tell stories of a time long ago, centuries ago, when God promised that he would deliver Israel, his people, to a promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey, as it says in Scripture. And you hear this story with some hope, and I think you have to, because without hope, I don't know how you get up under those circumstances and live each day. And you probably tell your children this same story so that they'll have some hope in their own lives, because we have to have hope. But I think deep down, when all you've ever known for 400 and some odd years as a people is this bondage, it would be difficult to have hope. Now imagine that a man who you once knew but became estranged to you returns. He had fled not with pride or being loved, but he fled in disgrace to go hide in the wilderness out of fear that he might be killed by the people of Egypt or the people of Israel, his own people. Imagine that he comes to your elders and he says, "When I was in the wilderness at Mount Sinai, I saw God in the form of a burning bush. And God spoke to me through that fire, and he said that I am the one to lead you out of captivity. I am the one who God has sent to save my people, to save you, to save God's people. God has heard your cry, and I am the one." I can't speak for any of you, and I can't speak for anybody living in Egypt at that time. But if somebody came up to me and said that God had spoken to them in the form of a burning bush and they were here to save me from captivity and servitude, the first question that would come to my mind would likely be, "What are you on?" I don't know that I would have a lot of faith in this person coming to me. I think there was probably something greater in that moment. You could feel God's presence maybe, but I think it would be easy to question. But I could also imagine and empathize that the Israelites may have said, "We've only known bondage, and we have no hope to get out of this, and there seems to be little cost to trusting in this man. So we'll allow him to go to Pharaoh on our behalf and ask for us to be released to worship God out in the wilderness so that we might be free." And I want you to imagine that this man goes and intervenes with Pharaoh on your behalf, and that Pharaoh's heart remains hardened. And instead of freeing you, he just says, "The reason that you want to leave and go worship in the wilderness is because you're lazy." And so he doubles your burden. He doubles your workload. He tells the slave drivers to be crueler, to be meaner, to hold you accountable for twice the work but needing to get done the same amount. And your life gets harder And you might go to this man who'd promised you freedom and say, "You promised us salvation, but yet my life is more difficult now. I didn't think it could get worse, and yet you've somehow made it worse." And that man tells you it's okay, trust in God. He's going to harden Pharaoh's heart, but it's only so that he can display the miracles that he needs to display to you and to the Egyptians so that you might be saved. And so you continue to trust in this man, and he goes to Pharaoh time and time again, and the plagues that he promises will come, and Pharaoh's heart remains hard as he said it would remain hard. And maybe you even see this as a sign from God. Maybe you do see that maybe God's working somehow here, and then that the Egyptians are the ones suffering at the hands of God's plagues, and you look around at your neighbors and your family and your loved ones, and you seem to be the ones who are passed by. You're okay. You've not been harmed. But I think it would be easy to say, we still are in bondage. We're still in captivity. Pharaoh's heart remains hard. I don't know that there would be a lot of hope there, and I think it would be difficult to have trust in this man who's intervening on your behalf. But he comes to you one last time and he says, "This is the last thing that you have to do. Follow these instructions and tomorrow you will be free." There's one more sign that God has to show to soften Pharaoh's heart and to allow you to be released into the wilderness so that you can inherit the land that was promised. And so you do as instructed, and you take part in the first Passover meal, and you put the mark on your house as you were instructed. And you could be forgiven, I think, if you went to sleep that night, maybe thinking, "I'm going to wake up tomorrow still a slave. Will anything really change?" But to your surprise, you wake up early the next morning, not to screams of pain or terror, but to shouts of joy. You go outside and you meet your neighbors and you wake your family, and everybody's celebrating. They're praising God and they're joyous because Pharaoh has not only finally agreed to release you from captivity, but he and the Egyptian people are begging you to leave their land, because they want relief from the punishment that your God has inflicted upon them. Try and imagine the joy that you would feel after centuries of captivity to finally be released into freedom, to finally be able to worship your God as you see fit, to live a life that you see fit, and to know that there's hope for the first time, not just for you, but for your children and your children's children. To know that the promise God had made centuries ago to your ancestors, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, has been fulfilled. Now, it didn't go that smoothly after they escaped Egypt. There was, of course, one last miracle with the parting of the sea and the Israelites crossing on dry land and the Egyptians being stopped once and for all from pursuing them. But just imagine that feeling when you finally get to the foot of Mount Sinai and you know that there's no more pursuer, there's no more captivity, there's no more bondage. And while you're at Mount Sinai, Moses, who has been your leader this whole time, is going up and communicating with God and bringing back regulations and laws on how to live a good and holy life. And he's bringing back instructions for how to properly sacrifice and make atonement between you and God so that you can have a relationship with God. I would imagine it was a great deal of joy and excitement in those years for Israel as a nation. I want you to imagine, if you can, how much trust the Israelites had to have in this one person to deliver them. I don't think they could have just trusted this one man. There was clearly a lot of trust in God and a higher power there as well. But just imagine the trust that you had to have in this person who was speaking to you on behalf of God. I look around today, and I don't, whether it's in D.C. or Indianapolis or within corporate offices, I don't see a leader who could possibly lead a people the way that Moses led Israel out of captivity. If you look at our political landscape, Republicans don't trust Democrats. Democrats don't trust Republicans. And then you have libertarians who trust nobody, especially the government. But I think that the biggest problem with our current landscape, with our society today, is that lack of trust. The reason that Israel became the strong nation that it was out of captivity is because God understood the importance of trust, and he instructed from the very beginning Israel on how to live a trustworthy and honest life so that they could form a strong society. I've been contemplating honesty and trustworthiness a great deal the last few months, and I can't say what's brought it to my mind. I'm not really sure. But it ultimately led me to the book of Leviticus and chapter 27 specifically. And I'll set up Leviticus a little bit. It's nothing but a book of rules and regulations and instructions on how to properly sacrifice to God, making sin offerings or just offerings around holidays, or how to appropriately tithe to the priests, and instructions on how to live a holy life. I think you could break Leviticus down into two parts, and the two main themes of it are how to live a holy life and how to worship a holy God. And these are the instructions that the Israelites are getting from Moses at the foot of Mount Sinai, the years that they're there, waiting to wander through the wilderness and finally inherit the promised land. And the reason that they could not just go into the promised land is because God had to first teach them how to be a functioning society, how to be a functioning nation. He had to lay the groundwork. He had to lay the foundation. And I think the foundation is trust. This is shown, I believe, in Leviticus 27, verses 9 through 15, where God is speaking on vows made to him. But these are not required vows. These are extra vows, extra promises and gifts that the Israelites offer to their God. Maybe as a sign of extra faith, or they were just overcome with faith and praise and joy that they wanted to give a little something extra. And so God is instructing the priests on how to handle these offerings. Starting in 27, verse 9, God instructs, "If your vow involves giving an animal that is acceptable as an offering to the Lord, any gift to the Lord will be considered holy. You may not exchange or substitute it for another animal, neither a good animal for a bad one, nor a bad one for a good one. But if you do exchange one animal for another, then both the original animal and its substitute will be considered holy. If your vow involves an unclean animal, one that is not acceptable as an offering to the Lord, then you must bring the animal to the priest. He will assess its value, and his assessment will be final, whether high or low. If you want to buy back the animal, you must pay the value set by the priest plus 20%. If someone dedicates a house to the Lord, the priest will come to assess its value. The priest's assessment will be final, whether high or low. If the person who dedicated the house wants to buy it back, he must pay the value set by the priest plus 20%. Then the house will again be his." I want to focus on the buying back of an offering, and the 20% penalty is the word that I'll use here, but I don't really like it. But the 20% extra that you would pay in addition to the assessed value if you wanted to buy back an offering. And you might ask, why the penalty? I think a lot of people would just assume it's punishment for going back on your word, and maybe that's part of it. But I think it was more of an atonement. Because remember, the Israelites had to handle the problem of sin before they could have a relationship with God. And when we go back on our vows, whether to God or to each other, whether we break our oaths to God or to each other, by breaking that, we're being dishonest. And if we're dishonest, that is a form of sin. It's a form of wrong living. And so the 20% that God lays out to be paid for the offering that you'd made is not a form of punishment, but a form of atonement. It's a way of saying that what I gave you, I need back so badly that I'm willing to pay an increased cost to myself to redeem it. It makes you right with the priests, it makes you right with your people, and it makes you right with God. And why God took these vows so seriously that he felt you had to atone if you broke them was because God understood that without trust, without honest living, society couldn't stand. He knew that Israel, whether he delivered them to the promised land or not, would ultimately collapse if they hadn't built a society that was founded on trust. God lays this out multiple times throughout the Old Testament. In Numbers 30, verse 2, God says, "A man who makes a vow to the Lord or makes a pledge under oath must never break it. He must do exactly what he said he would do." This again is God instructing through Moses the Israelites in the wilderness on the importance of trust, on the importance of keeping your word. And I would ask you, imagine that you're talking to somebody, whether a business partner or a potential business partner, a friend, a family member, or just a stranger. If they said that I will do X and didn't do X, how much trust would you have in that person? If they said I will be at this place at this time and they failed to arrive, how much trust would you have in that person? When we go back on our word, we're being dishonest. And when we're dishonest, we break trust. And when we break trust, we can't form relationships with individuals. And if we break trust collectively, then you can't have a functioning society. I've thought a lot about honesty lately and how we define it. And I think for myself and maybe for others, I've always kind of thought about honesty as you answer a question truthfully. And maybe being able to pass a polygraph test is part of being honest and living honestly. But I think that honesty is an action. It is not our words. Honesty is pledging to do something and doing it. Honesty is vowing to not do something and not doing it. Honesty is an action. And I think that that's what God is instructing to the Israelites, is that you have to act honestly in order to survive. I think a lot of people read through this, and I think they already know the verses in Matthew that I'll cite here on vows. I think there's a tendency with some Christians today to say that the New Testament has made the Old obsolete in some way, or there's wisdom in the Old Testament, but somehow Jesus' teachings were new or supersede this in some way. And I think that's mistaken. In Matthew 5, verses 17 through 19, Jesus teaches about the law and how he's not superseding the law or making it irrelevant or making the prophecies irrelevant, but fulfilling them. Starting in verse 17, Jesus says, "Don't misunderstand why I have come. I did not come to abolish the law of Moses or the writings of the prophets. No, I came to accomplish their purpose. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not even the smallest detail of God's law will disappear until its purpose is achieved. So if you ignore the least commandment and teach others to do the same, you will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But anyone who obeys God's laws and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven." I think there's a tendency to look at a book like Leviticus specifically and say that what has been taught there is irrelevant. And I think a perfect example of that is the animal sacrifices that are described. I think that often there's a tendency, particularly within secular communities, to say that these were barbaric practices and that we should not interpret this word literally, but that these were ancient practices done by an uncivilized people. I think that with the correct interpretation, we can read a book like Leviticus in a literal sense, because Jesus was not saying that the animal sacrifice was unnecessary or that God had taught anything wrong or was incorrect in his teaching to the Israelites. Keep in mind that the Israelites did not have a Messiah at the time. He had not been born, and he had not lived, and he had not been sacrificed on the cross yet. In order to have a relationship with a perfectly holy God, imperfect, unholy people had to deal with the problem of sin. And in order to deal with the problem of sin, God created a system of sacrifice in order to deal with that. And keep in mind that every calf, every lamb, every goat that was sacrificed had to be perfect with no blemishes. It could not have broken bones, it cannot have bruises or defects of any kind. This was ultimately setting the table For the ultimate sacrifice that was Christ, the perfect sacrifice, the ultimate atonement for our sin. The Israelites needed the animal sacrifices to be right with God and to have a relationship with God. We do not need that today because Christ has been sacrificed on our behalf. That is how we find redemption and how we can have a relationship with God today. Jesus was not making these laws irrelevant. He was fulfilling them, and he will continue to fulfill them until the end. Jesus teaches on vows as well, and I think verses 33 through 37 in Matthew 5 have a tendency to be misinterpreted. Jesus teaches, "You have also heard that our ancestors were told, 'You must not break your vows, you must carry out the vows you make to the Lord.' But I say, do not make any vows. Do not say, 'By heaven,' because heaven is God's throne. And do not say, 'By the earth,' because the earth is his footstool. And do not say, 'By Jerusalem,' for Jerusalem is the city of the great king. And do not even say, 'By my head,' for you can't turn one hair white or black. Just say a simple, 'Yes, I will,' or 'No, I won't.' Anything beyond this is from the evil one." And Jesus' brother James, in his letter in chapter 5, verse 12, reiterates this, saying, "But most of all, my brothers and sisters, never take an oath by heaven or earth or anything else. Just say a simple yes or no, so that you will not sin and be condemned." I think there's a misinterpretation here sometimes where we think that what Jesus is teaching is to never swear a vow or make an oath or make a promise or vow anything on God's name or vow or swear anything on a Bible or swear anything to the earth or on your own head. I think that that's a mistake. As I interpret this, Jesus is not teaching that God's lesson to the Israelites was irrelevant. He was not saying that offering a vow is somehow wrong or sinful. But what Christ was teaching was that if you swear something or take an oath on anything, you'd better keep your word. Because Jesus understood, as God taught the Israelites, that you cannot have a society or community or relationships or a family without trust. When you go back on your word, you break trust. If you vow that you'll do something and you go back on that, then you've broken trust within your community. You've betrayed honesty. And you've started living a dishonest life. And so Jesus is teaching that if you keep your word, if you are so true to your word that you any vow you make, you keep seriously, and any time you promise to be anywhere for anybody, you're there, and any time you promise not to do something, you don't do it. If you keep your promises, if you keep these vows, then there's no need to swear an oath. There's no need to take a vow. There's no need to put your hand on a Bible. There's no need to do any of that. Because when you say you'll do something, people know that you will. When you say you'll be somewhere, people know you'll be there. In short, people have faith in your word and trust in you and your word. And without that, you lose the foundations for relationships, not just with people, but with God. And when you lose that foundation of trust because you behaved in a dishonest way, you doom the people around you and you doom your society. I want to kind of wrap up here with a personal anecdote about honesty and something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And oftentimes my wife will go to bed before I do. And as she goes to bed, sometimes she doesn't have time to get the coffee ready. She's just too tired. And so she'll ask me, "Troy, will you get the coffee ready for tomorrow morning?" And it's an easy request, incredibly simple. And so I say, "Yes, of course I will." Well, probably to the surprise of no wives out there, I succeed at this about half the time. And so my wife goes to bed knowing that there's probably a coin toss chance that she'll wake up to coffee, which is okay because Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts aren't that far away. But it seems like a minor thing, right? But at least on this one thing, this one request, my wife essentially knows that my word on this is garbage. And while it doesn't necessarily matter with the coffee in the morning, that's not going to make or break a relationship, It's these little acts of dishonesty that can sow the seeds of distrust. And that they can harm a relationship if it's allowed to become bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I'll end with a call to action here and say, think about honesty and consider times in your life when maybe you've been dishonest with yourself or with others, no matter how big or small the infraction. And think about ways that you can get better. Think about ways that you can be more honest in your living. But above all, don't beat yourself up over it. No one's perfect. And there is a reason that we needed Christ to die for our sins. That is the ultimate atonement. But we can always get better. And we can always work on things and improve over time.